Okay,
well, it's going.
Okay. It's going.
We're getting ready to start here, folks. I'm Baron. I'm a very grateful Rilla colleague. It's been my honor and pleasure to introduce our main speaker for today from Tarzana, California. Here we got Dusty. Let's give him a hand.
Hi, my name is Dusty Brocious. I'm an alcoholic. I use my last name, and I use a lot of other people's last names in Alcoholics Anonymous because what's said here is kept here, right? So, you know, I heard Bill Wilson tell, I heard that Bill Wilson told the guy, because I didn't hear him. You know, he says, don't be so anonymous that your sponsor doesn't know who you are. So, you know, we're anonymous outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, a lot of the stuff I share today are things that I've learned in 27 years of sobriety. My sobriety date is November 27th, 1990. My last drink was November 17th, but I continued to partake in a little bit of that green stuff. I love smoking marijuana, just did. And I didn't know that being sober meant no marijuana either, you know. I'd been hitting a few meetings, and I was one of these guys that I'd get up and I heard the buses that came in, you know, the guys from the buses would say, you know, alcoholic Anda. And so I'd say the same thing I wanted to be a part of, alcoholic Anda. And, you know, so one of the old timers, some crotchety fella, I'm sure, told me, you know, he says, well, if you're an alcoholic Anda, then put a dollar in for the alcohol and a dollar for the Anda. And I thought, no, I'm just putting in $1, you know. Another guy told me, he says, don't be different. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Be an alcoholic. Be a part of. And I've been sponsoring a lot of guys. I've been sponsored by a wonderful man. He spoke here a couple of months ago, Ed Perry from Ojai. And, I mean, I met him at one of my first AA meetings. And, you know, he's been a wonderful guide for me for 27 years. He never tells me what to do. He just shows me what to do. He tells me what he does. He tells me what his sponsor tells him. And every time he does, I know he's talking to me. You know, he tried to tell me something. Anyhow, my drinking started when I was 12 years old. I got together with some buddies, and we stole some liquor out of the Lee's liquor cabinet. And we went back to the old barn that was behind the next-door neighbors, and we started drinking. And I wanted to feel like the adults that we were seeing. The Lees were a family of entertainers. They had two grand pianos in their living room. Mr. Lee had trombones and saxophones. And Tim and Gary were both very good musicians. Diana was a singer. She sang professionally. You know, there was a lot of entertainment going on in that house. And I would see famous people come in that home, and they would start to drink. And when they'd come to the party, they were dressed like I am today. And they'd start to drink, and they'd loosen their tie up, they'd take their jacket off, and they'd start telling jokes they shouldn't tell in front of 12-year-old kids. And I thought it was great. And I wanted to be like they were. I could see the joy and the happiness that they were having, and I equated it to the alcohol they were drinking. And I wanted that feeling. I wanted what they had. And so we stole that bottle of liquor, went back to the barn. I blacked out, passed out, came to, found out that I had done some silly things. I found out that I had puked all over myself, and they threw me in the shower to wash the puke off my clothes and myself. And when I came to, I was laid out in the backyard under the sun trying to dry out, you know, and they were laughing about the silliness that I had done. And I thought it was great. And I couldn't wait to do that again. I couldn't remember what I'd done, but I couldn't wait to do whatever it was again. And that was the way I would drink. And I didn't drink every day from that point on. I drank, you know, maybe once a month. And then as time progressed, I drank more often. I was just about 18 years old when I moved out of the house. My parents were very glad to see me go. And I was really happy to leave. And me and a couple friends, we rented a house, and it was a party house. We would buy large quantities of marijuana and buy large quantities of alcohol, and we'd sell the pot so we could buy more and pay for the booze. And I mean, that's how we did it. And that was fun until I got drafted. I did not want to be a veteran. But I know today freedom is not free. There's a very heavy price to be paid. My brother-in-law was one of those that paid that price. He was a radio man in the Marines in Vietnam. And he was taken out by Agent Orange, you know, years later. He was buried to my sister and two beautiful kids, had a wonderful job, was really he was a good example of what a man is. I didn't like him when I was drinking and using because I couldn't be that type of a man. I didn't know how to be. And I didn't like him. And I didn't like my other brother-in-law either because he was the same way. They were responsible. They were there for their wives and their kids. They were making plans for the future and doing things that, you know, men do. And I didn't know how to do that. And I'm run by fear. I am filled with fear. And if I don't know how to do something, I don't have the capacity to ask you to help me. I do today, but I didn't then. And when I was drafted, I wasn't going to go in the Army. I wasn't going to go. I was going to let them throw me in jail. And it was my brother-in-law, at the time, he was in the National Guard, and he came over to the house and he said, you know, you can do anything you want. Your sister and I will be here for you. We will do anything we can for you. But think about this. If you go to jail, you can be in jail for 6 years. And you don't get to come home for Christmas. You don't get to go out for holidays. You don't get any of the things that free people get. If you go in the Army, you'll only be in there for 2 years. And you'll be able to come home on holidays. And you'll be able to do this and that. And he sold me on the idea that maybe it would be a better idea to go ahead and be drafted. And it was right at the end of the Vietnam War. Now, I will fight to protect everybody in this room. But I wasn't real thrilled with the idea of going to Vietnam and fighting for something that I didn't understand or believe in. And so I decided, okay, I'll let them, you know, I'll get drafted. When I went in to get my operator's training, they asked me, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go home. And no. No, what do you really want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to be an MP. Well, I had already gotten in a little bit of trouble, and the MPs don't like that. So, you know, I did go to MP school in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and I got there, and they looked at my records, and they said, we're going to put you on the Beltline. And on the Beltline, you're there at Fort Gordon waiting for them to decide if you pass or if you fail. And my second choice of, I forget what they called it, MOS or whatever it was, my second choice was to be a truck driver, and they decided I would be a better truck driver than a police officer. And my wife will disagree with them. She says I would have made a great cop because I'm observant. I'm always looking at things. I'm always watching. I'm always kind of, I don't know if that would have really made me a good cop or not, but it's not what I did. I ended up being a truck driver, and I loved doing that. I loved to drive. Thank you for the invitation up here. The drive up here was beautiful. The dinner last night was really nice. The hospitality, everybody that joined us for dinner, if you haven't had a chance to join them for dinner when a speaker comes up, you know, join them. It was really marvelous. It was a wonderful evening. And the hotel is nice. And Laura and I thank you for that. And Laura's my running buddy. We've been together for 18 years now. And It's been a marvelous journey. And so my drinking got worse as I, you know, moved out of the house, got my own place with friends, got into the Army. I got into trouble a couple of times in the Army because of my drinking. One of the times I had borrowed, I was in North Carolina. It was where they were teaching us to drive trucks, and that was really fun. I really enjoyed that. But I borrowed somebody's car, and we were out drinking, and I'm driving back on the roads that we drove the trucks on, And I'm, you know, getting this little car to go sideways in the dirt road, and, you know, we're having fun, and come around a corner, and there's a puddle, and I hit that puddle, and all of a sudden I hydroplaned off that road and through the bushes, and there were a bunch of little trees, except for the one I hit, you know. And I totaled that car out, and I got a write-up for that, you know, bad boy, don't do that again, and you know, so, you know, alcohol was starting to affect my life, but I couldn't see it. Went to Germany. I was, because the Vietnam War was ending and they weren't sending draftees to Vietnam, I was sent to Germany. And I'm one of these people that if you ask for a volunteer, I say, okay. And you were told not to do that in the Army. You know, if they ask you to volunteer, don't do it. And I did. And they said, we need a volunteer. And I raised my hand and they said, we need you to drive the USO tour bus. Now, you know, that's really a nice job, driving the USO tour bus. One of the jobs of doing that was I had to drive the accountants from where we were stationed to all of the other different caserns or forts, and they would do their inventory, and I would follow behind them, and I would clean out their inventory and come back and sell it to the guys at the base. And so I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief. Most of what I tell you today is true. And so, you know, I was doing that, and my drinking was getting worse. My drug use was getting worse, but I didn't see the problem. I got to drive families around Europe with the USO tour bus on weekends. We would take weekend trips, and we'd visit different castles, or we'd go to different mountains, or we'd do different things. And I never gave it any consideration that I'm drinking and smoking hash and driving. It's not a good combination. And I've got families in this bus with me. I have absolutely no regard for anybody else's safety. And I thought it was normal. That's good. But it gets worse, never better. And got out of the Army, came back to the United States. A buddy of mine was driving trucks for a freight company. And I said, you know, Joe, help me out. Get me some work, will you? And so Joe taught me how to drive the 13-speed. And then later on, he taught me how to drive a 4-4, which is two sticks, two transmissions, 4-speed main box, 4-speed auxiliary box. And I learned how to do that. And I'm drinking and driving when I'm learning how to drive. I'm driving, you know, 80,000 pounds worth of truck, trailers, and whatever we're hauling. With no regard to the people that are on the road with me. A lot of the guys that I hung around with, Bear said it. Bear, thank you for your share. You know, I don't hang around people that don't drink and do what I do. You know, if you don't do what I do, I don't trust you. And so when Bear said that, that's me for sure. And then I got a job working for the city of Los Angeles. Started off as a truck driver and worked my way up the ranks to a supervisor. I was a yard supervisor for a while, different yards that I worked in. And then I got to promoted up to being a street services supervisor out in the middle of the street where I'm waving at people as they go by, flipping me off. You know, we break the road down to one lane, and you're late to work, and it's your 15th time, and you're going to get fired. You're not happy with me. You know, my crew's shutting the thing down, and so I was like Bear. You know, I'd get to work, I'd have everything planned, figured out, I'd have stuff marked out, whatever needed to be done. I'd tell the crew what we're doing, where's the material coming from, what our trucking's going to be today, and so that they would know how much work we had to get done today. And that's all we did was today. And at lunchtime, I would go to drink my lunch, and I would forget to come back to work. Well, my superintendent didn't like that too much, and he'd come by and he'd ask the crew, you know, where's Brocious? And they said, oh, he went down to San Pedro to check out that job that we're doing. And then he'd call me in the office the next day and say, you know, I want you on the job the first thing in the morning. I want you there before lunch. I want you there after lunch. And I want you there at the end of the day. I'd say, oh, okay, yeah, I'll do that. Well, the only problem with that is that I'd go to lunch and drink. I'd drink my lunch. Canned ham sandwiches is what I was told. So I'd go drink a couple of canned ham sandwiches, and then I'd continue to have more and more. And it finally got to the point they had written me up a couple of times and they were threatening me with, we're going to let you go. You know, if you don't straighten this up, we're going to give you days off. And you know, I couldn't understand, you know, why do you, my jobs are getting done. The work's being done. Paperwork's getting in a little late, but everything else is getting done, you know. And, you know, so they were starting to get on me. Laura is wife number three. I'm husband number three. So we've learned that in California, three strikes is life, and we hope it is. We've had 18 wonderful years together, and we do hope that it is life. So anyhow, you know, wife number one left me just about the same time I was getting into trouble at work, and I couldn't understand why she left me. I'm such a wonderful husband. A liar, cheat, and a thief. There were a lot of nights that I would forget to come home, and she didn't appreciate that. And, you know, I wouldn't appreciate it if my wife didn't come home, you know. So put the shoe on the other foot and see how you like it. And I sure wouldn't have, but I was doing that. I didn't know how to not do that. You know, I didn't know how to not drink. And so I'm having troubles at work. My wife has left me. She's left me with two teenage children. And they don't like me because they know that their mother left us because I'm such a wonderful man. And they weren't real happy with me. And so I've got, you know, I got marital problems, I've got children problems, I've got work problems, and it's everybody else just doesn't understand. And so then I went out to Paso Robles and visited with some friends in Paso, Mid-State Fair, August of 1990. And Sunday morning, I know I'm leaving Sunday morning to go back to L.A. And I made a conscious decision in my mind not to have a drink that day because I was leaving. And I've done it a lot of times where I've made a conscious decision not to drink. I mean, I experimented with sobriety before I came to the rooms of AA. So I thought I'd been sober for months. It might have been a few days because it certainly wasn't months from when the wife left me to August. And so, you know, I hadn't been sober for months, but I thought I had. And so when I got to Paso Robles, Nancy asked me if I'd like a VO7. And that was one of my drinks, VO7. And so I said, sure, I'll have a VO7 because, you know, I've been sober for so long now, maybe, you know, 4 days or something. I don't know what I really don't know what it was, but I, you know, it was. And so I had a drink Friday night after I got there, and I drank all weekend. And Sunday morning we were leaving, you know, I, myself, and I. My kids wouldn't even come with me. They didn't want to go to Paso Robles with me. And they wouldn't even let me bring my dogs. I had two bull mastiffs, and they wouldn't let me take my dogs with me to Paso Robles. You know, it was, nobody liked me. And, you know, so like I said, I wasn't going to drink. And I drank. Sunday morning, I went to the sports pub down the street and was throwing darts, and Mark came in and said, hey, Dusty, you want a Bloody Mary? My alcoholic thinking said, oh, I can have just one. You know, I didn't really understand alcoholism. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. You know, I had the movie version, the Hollywood version of what an alcoholic was, but it wasn't me. And so I said, sure, I can have just one. Well, as little of a gentleman that I am, I knew that, you know, you don't let a friend drink alone. And he bought me one, so I got to buy him one. So I'll just have the second one. And that started my drinking for the day. And when I left Paso Robles, I don't remember leaving Paso Robles. When I rear-ended the onion hauler going up the grapevine, I don't remember that. All I know is I came to and there were taillights in my windshield, and I knew that wasn't a good thing. And being a Class A driver and having to have a license for my job, my first thought was I've got to run. Excuse me. It's hard to run when your engine and transmission are sitting in the passenger seat next to you. But I didn't know that at the time. I tried to start the engine and couldn't figure out why it won't start. And you know, so Highway Patrol came, arrested me. on the highway, they had a little tiny machine that I blew into, and it said that I was blowing a .27, and I knew that couldn't be right. And so then we did the paperwork, whatever. The highway patrolman went up, measured things, did his thing, whatever. Then took me to the station there at Lebec, and had me blow into a big machine. And that big machine, and I don't know how long we'd been on the side of the road. I'm thinking we were there about an hour. I don't know. The accident was at around 9:30 in the evening, and by the time they got me to Bakersfield, it was just after midnight. So my actual booking date is on the 13th of August. And he had me blow into a big machine at Lebec, and I was still blowing a .27. So I don't know if I was going up, coming down, or where I was going sideways, but I was definitely drunk and was in trouble and didn't know what the problem was. Everybody's just picking on me. Well, you know what? Why can't they just understand? So I didn't know what to do, and I really wanted to get wife number one back. So I begged her to go to marriage counseling with me, and she said, "No, the marriage is over. We're done." And so, you know, like a good alcoholic, I conned her into going with me. I told her, "Well, I need to know what I'm doing wrong so that you know the next marriage won't be this way, you know, or whatever. Lying, cheating, and stealing." So I got her to go, and she went with me three times. And the whole time that we were going, I'm lying to this therapist. And she's just shaking her head. And at the third session, when it was over, she said, "I'm not coming back here anymore." And what she did was she reached inside my chest, pulled my heart out, threw it on the ground, stomped on it, and walked away. And I realized in sobriety, I had been doing the same thing to her, but piece by piece. We were married for 18 years. So piece by piece, I was tearing out a little piece of her heart and throwing it on the ground and stomping on it. Little piece, piece. How painful is that? You know, how cruel could I be? But I didn't know it. I didn't see it. I couldn't understand it. She was very kind by ripping it out once and stepping on it that one time and walking away and being done with it. Today, we're friends with them. You know, and in fact, we kind of laughed because we were told at the hotel to Charlene would be the one we needed to find. Well, that's my ex-wife, and her husband is Frank, and we were having dinner at Frank's place. So Frank and Charlene. So Laura and I kind of chuckled about that last night. So she left me and left me with the two kids, and I had lied to this therapist for months. And she left me in May. We went to the first therapy in June, and so June, July, August, I'm lying to this therapist about everything and trying to tell her the lies that will get my wife back. You know, we work really hard at trying to convince other people that already know. So after a bit, I finally had an experience where I went out and I wasn't going to drink that night. And I drank. And I drank into a blackout. And I came to in my own bed. I didn't know it when I first came to, but I came to with a white light experience. And it was one of these white light experiences that the light didn't blind me, but all I could see was the light. Couldn't see the bed or the walls or anything else. And then a voice said, "You haven't learned yet." And that was November 17th, 1990. And I didn't know what that was, and it was a little scary, and I was sweating and shaking, and I didn't know what now. So Thursday I went to go see this therapist. So from the 17th to Thursday when I went to see the therapist, I was still smoking marijuana. And I told her the truth about my drinking, told her the truth about the drug use, told her the truth about the car accident. I hadn't told anybody about the car accident. The only people that knew about that was my brother who picked me up out of jail and the court systems, you know, Highway Patrol, DMV, those people, but nobody else knew, you know, because I kept those things under my vest. You know, don't tell anybody your secrets. So I got honest with this therapist. And I believe it was the first time I've ever been honest with anybody. And I started telling her the truth about everything I could think of. And when I got done, she asked me, "Would you be willing to do a homework assignment for me?" And I looked at her, and at that point in my life, I was done. I didn't know I was done, but I was done. And I said, okay. You know, Thursday earlier, I would have asked her, well, what do you want me to do? How much is it going to cost me? How long is it going to take? And what are you going to get out of it? You know, everybody's got something getting out of it, you know. But I didn't do that. I just said, okay. And she handed me a phone number. She said, call this number, go to 2 meetings in the next week, and come back and tell me what you think. She didn't say AA. She didn't say Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't say anything other than, call this number and go to 2 meetings. And I got home that afternoon. I took a couple of bong loads and picked up the phone and dialed the number. And this golden voice says, Alcoholics Anonymous, may we help you. My first thought was, why am I calling them? Is this 988-3001? You know, she said, yeah, can we help you? And I said, yeah. Can you tell me where the meeting is? Like there's one meeting in all of Los Angeles, you know? You know, I had this concept, you know, really bad concept, but I had this concept. And she said, well, where do you live? Oh, my God, I'm not telling her where I live. And at the time, I was up near Topanga and Roscoe. I was a few blocks away from there, and I figured, oh, if I tell her Topanga and Roscoe, they can find that, but they won't find me. So she said, oh, there's a meeting down at Sherman Way in Topanga. It starts at 7 o'clock, and, you know, it was like 6 o'clock in the evening. She said, there's time for you to get there. And I said, oh, yeah, thanks. Bye. Hung up. Took a couple more bong loads and thought, God, I am so tired. I'm really tired. I'll go tomorrow. And I did that until Tuesday night because I knew Tuesday, Wednesday were the 2 meetings I was going to have to hit to go back see her on Thursday and tell her I did those meetings. And the first meeting I walked into, it was a Tuesday night at the Cabrito House. It's a men's recovery house on Remet and Satakoi, real close to where I lived. And I got there, and when I got there, the parking lot was full. It wasn't really a parking lot. It was a circular driveway, and it was full. And there was no place to park. I was going to have to park 3 houses down the street. So I turned around, and I started to go home. And that same voice that I heard on the 17th that said, you know, you haven't learned yet, said, you promised. Now, I've made a lot of promises that I've never kept. But for some reason, that voice said, you promised. And it caused me to make a U-turn, go back to that recovery house, park 3 houses down the street, and walk into this AA meeting, because I don't know why she wants me to go there. I am not an alcoholic. And so I walked into that meeting. I don't know if they were reading 3, 5, 7. I don't know what chapter they were reading. They were reading something. The podium up there at the front said, what does it say? Yeah, we care. And I thought, we care? Yeah, sure. Okay. So I sat next to the door at the back row. For those that don't know, the back row is the shoe section, slippers, sneakers, and loafers. And that's where I was. I was sitting back there with the sneakers, loafers, and slippers. And I didn't know it. That's where I belonged, but I didn't know it. So I'm sitting back there, and at the break, this guy comes walking out to the parking lot and says, you know, hey, my name's Frank. How you doing, man? And, are you new? How can you tell? And, you know, he asked me a really stupid question. Do you have a directory? I don't even know what a directory is, but I don't think I got one. Let me look. No directory. He says, well, hang on a second. He hollers at some other guy. Hey, Mark, go get him a directory. And this guy, Mark, comes back, and he brings a directory, and I start to reach out for it, and instead he gives it to Frank. He said, he told you to give it to me. But he gave it to Frank, and Frank says to me, he says, now I want you to go to all these meetings until you find the meetings that you like. I had no idea what he meant. You know, I was like, yeah, okay, give me the directory. Thanks. And the meeting started, went back in. Now, one of the really positive, powerful things that happened that night, that beautiful Tuesday night, was besides the podium saying, we care, they had the 12 steps on the back behind the podium. And the first step, I read that. Back then, I didn't need glasses. Back then, I could read all of the steps on the wall without binoculars or glasses or magnifying glasses or anything else. And I read that first step. And as soon as I read that first step, I was done. I was done. I didn't know. I didn't know that I didn't know. And it says, we admit it. We. You know, the we care is important because it's we. And that's what we are. And then we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That our lives had become unmanageable. And all of my life, my parents, some of my friends, they all said, you need to. And you know, all I did was turn my back on those people because I don't need to be around people like that. But AA said we. AA made me a part of it without my permission. I walked out of that room knowing that I am powerless over alcohol. I wasn't real sure that my life was unmanageable, but, you know, I'm definitely powerless over alcohol. I went back to a Wednesday night meeting at 4 p.m. At the Hole in the Sky, and I went there because it was dart night, Wednesday night dart night, and I was the captain of the team, and I had to be there, responsibilities, you know. So Wednesday night I went to this men, I think it was a men's stag, because all of the guys that were there were all men. There were no women, I don't know, I just looked at 4 p.m. meeting, oh, that'll work, I can do my darts too. All these guys said, you know, I got drunk again. I got kicked out of the house again. I'm sleeping under the park bench again. I'm out here on the bus bench again. I lost my house. I lost my car. I lost my wife. I lost my job. And they were all saying again, again. And I saw that and I thought, whoa, I don't want this. And I looked at Tuesday night and I said, I want that. I really do want that. I want the smiles and the camaraderie that I saw, the joy. As we were sitting here this morning, Laura and I were sitting there eating our breakfast, and several people came up to talk with us and really made us feel a part of and comfortable. And as everybody slowly walked into the room, there was that buzz that goes on, all the conversations, everybody, and the laughter. You know, the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Laura and I just loved the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to that Wednesday night meeting and saw what I didn't want. And then Thursday night I went back to that Cabrito house. There was a book study in that meeting, or in that hall that night. And that's where I met my sponsor, Ed Perry. And I sat next to him just because there was a seat next to him, not for any other reason. Asked him where I could get one of these books that he was reading. He said, oh, I've got one right here. And he handed me a brand new book. And I was, you know, proud and arrogant and full of myself. And I wanted to pay it here. What do I owe you? You know, let me pay you. What do I owe you? You know, he says, no, it's a gift. So I took the gift. The week later, I went back to the Hole in the Sky because I saw they were selling big books, and so I bought one up there, and I brought it back to the Tuesday night or to the Thursday night book study, and I said, "Here's your book back." And he says, "No, that was a gift." He says, "Well," I said, "Well, I bought this for you." He says, "No, give that to a newcomer." I didn't even know what a newcomer was. Do what? Give it to who? So Ed started me off that way. And a lot of the meetings I went to, Ed was at those meetings. And it just was kind of pointing that direction, and I didn't know it. I'm a little slow. I had known another truck driver who had gotten sober before I went to work for the city of L.A. I knew he went to the Valley Club or something like that, so I found where the Valley Club was, and I went to find him, and I said, "Gino, what's happening, man? Hey, listen, Gino, I'm looking for a sponsor." And he looked at me, and he kind of put his head and eyes down to the floor, and he says, "I can't sponsor you." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because you've probably got more days than I do." Well, don't let that interfere with you. If somebody asks you to sponsor you, or if somebody asks you to be their sponsor, the answer is, okay, Are you willing to do what I ask you to do? Are you willing to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know if that would have saved Gino's life or not, but I know that it saved my life. Sponsoring guys, doing panels, doing general service, doing all those things, answering phones at central office, being a service. And anyhow, Gino said no, and Gino died a few months later from the disease of alcoholism. Just, you know, he drank himself to death. And so I asked Ed if he would sponsor me, because I kept seeing him at all these meetings that I was going to, the Sunday morning meeting. I went to a lot of meetings. I'm a lunchtime drunk. Okay, at lunchtime I would go drink and I would forget to come back to work. So at lunchtime I wanted to come back to work. And at lunchtime I wanted to stay sober. And so I looked in my directory to find a meeting near me. At the time I was working down in near Mar Vista, and my meeting directory was for the San Fernando Valley, and I couldn't find any meetings near me. So I turned to the front of the directory and I called the phone number, which is the 988-3001. And this guy answered the phone. I said, "Hey, I'm down in Mar Vista, man, and I can't find any meetings. Can you help me out?" So he told me where the Marina Club was down there on Washington Boulevard. And so I showed up there. I found out I also needed an LA directory. Today I've got my directory right here. These things are amazing. Wherever I go, except for here in Springville, I can find, I have Verizon, you know. So, you know, I can find an AA meeting anywhere I go. You know, I pull it out and I can look up a couple of different things and different websites, and I can find a meeting any place I go. You know, so I asked Ed to sponsor me, and he said, you know, okay, what are you willing to do? I don't know. He says, "Are you willing to do what I ask you to do?" Okay. He's never asked me to do anything. He just tells me what he does and what his sponsor does. And he guided me through the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did my fifth step with him. And that was very interesting for me because I'm very macho. And I went over to his house, and he lived with his brother and a couple of other guys at the time in this house. And he said, "Well, let's go in my bedroom where we can have some quiet." And I thought, okay. And then we get in there, and he says, "All right, let's get on our knees to do the third step prayer." Now, I've knelt in church before, but I've never knelt in anybody else's bedroom to pray. It's strange, and I did it. And then I did my fifth step with him. And that fifth step I found to be very freeing. It freed me up to do a lot more. I got involved with hospitals and institutions, the San Fernando Valley H&I Committee. A friend of mine at the Monday Night Men's Stag said, "Hey, Dusty, you know, what are you doing on," I forget what night it was, I think it was a Thursday night. He says, "What are you doing Thursday night?" And I said, "I'm just going to my regular book study." He says, "Well, can you take this panel for me?" I didn't know what a panel was. I didn't know what H&I was. I mean, I was fairly new. I was, I don't know, a month and a half sober at the time. Ed had taken me on my first panel when I was 20 days and took me to the Salvation Army. And on the way there, I said, "Where are we going, Ed?" "We're going to the Sally." I didn't know what the Sally was. I mean, I was pretty sheltered, I guess. I didn't know what the Sally was. And I said, "Well, you know, well, what are we going to this? What's the Sally, Ed?" He says, "It's the Salvation Army." I thought, "What's he think? I need clothes?" So I said, what are we going there for, Ed?" He says, "We're going to go talk to the fellas." Oh, you talk about fear. Fear ran right through to my toes. It was like, talk to the fellas. And I turned to Ed. I said, "Ed, I got nothing to say to these guys." He says, "That's okay. You just ask God to put the words in your mouth. You'll be all right." I don't know how long I talked. I might have talked about 2 minutes. You know, I got up there and said my name, and I don't know what I said. I said a couple things, I guess, and sat down. I sure wasn't up there for very long. And after that meeting was over, after that panel was over, these guys about yanked my arm right out of my socket and thanking me for coming there. And I couldn't understand it at first. And after a few years of sobriety, I realized it was because I was sicker than they were. And they appreciated seeing that. And but when I left there, I felt almost like there might be something I can do useful. You know, I never really felt like I could be useful in any area. But I had that feeling. So when I was asked to do this panel up at the Sylmar Juvenile Hall, I said, you know, okay, what do I do? And that kind of became my phrase, okay, what do I do? You know, Brent called and asked me if I wanted to come up here. I said, okay, what do I do? And he gave me all the information, and here I am. So I did that panel at the Salvation, at the Sylmar Juvenile Hall. And it was really kind of fun because the guy that asked me to do it said, there will be three guys that will meet you at the flagpole. And all you got to do is read the black print on the white page in the blue book, follow those directions, and let those three guys talk. Okay, I can do that. And it was absolutely amazing. I got there, and I was in my work clothes, and these three guys were standing there at the flagpole dressed in suit and ties to go into the Sylmar Juvenile Hall. I was impressed. And this is good. And so we went in, and these three fellows were absolutely amazing. I loved the opportunity to be there to read the black print on the white page in the blue book and follow a few directions. And then after that, Annie asked me if I'd do that panel from now on. I said, okay, what do I do? He says, well, all you got to do is go to H&I and tell them that you're taking this panel. And that, you know, sign up and give them your information. I said, great, okay. So I went to H&I. I didn't know that you were supposed to be a year sober to go into a lockdown facility. And I didn't know that Danny was the panel chairperson as well as a panel leader. And so I'm becoming the panel chairperson. You're supposed to have a year of sobriety before you do that. I've got a couple of months. And nobody questioned it. They said, oh, okay, well, welcome. Here's this. And off I went. I started doing that panel. At that H&I meeting, a guy by the name of Bob Fisher asked me if I wanted to go to jail. No, not really. He said, no, do a panel up at Wayside with me. I said, oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. Well, I was fairly new sober, and I still had some wants and warrants out for my arrest, and I didn't think about, you know, going to the sheriff's department jail to do a panel. They're not going to check us out because we're sober, right? So we walk through the sally port, and we hand them our driver's licenses. They give us a little clip to put on to show we're visitors, and we go inside, and we're waiting for the alkies to be brought into the meeting, and Bob turns to me, and he says, oh, I forgot to ask you. You don't have any wants or warrants, do you? I lied. No, Bob, no. I wanted Bob to like me, so the best way to get somebody to like you is to lie to them. I was still really screwed up, so... You know, we did the panel, and the whole time I'm doing the panel with Bob, I'm thinking, I'm going to jail tonight. I'm going to jail tonight. God, I'm going to jail tonight. I can't believe I'm going to go to jail tonight. So we got to the sally port. They handed me my license. We walked out through the gates into the parking lot. I knew they were waiting in the parking lot for us, and got to the car, and there was nobody there, and we hopped in the car, and we started out towards the main gate, and I they're waiting for me at the main gate. They're going to arrest me there. We drove through the main gate, and we got home, and I thought, I really liked doing that, but I didn't like the feeling of maybe being arrested, you know? So I called my employer that morning and said, I'm going to be a little late to work. I got personal business to take care of. I'm driving around without a license. I'm pretty new sober. And I'm going to court to pay my money. I didn't know that if I'd gone in front of the judge would have maybe given me a lot less, but I paid the full price. That's what I owed. Here it is. And I paid that. No more want or warrant. So now I was feeling good. And, I got into doing these panels, and it really did feel good. One of the panels that I took for a while was Lancaster State Prison. When it was brand new, they just opened it up, and some gal was trying to get people to come do the Lancaster Prison. And I said, okay, I'll go. And at the time, we were going out on Monday nights. And Monday night, we'd get there, and we'd go through the same entrance that the correctional officers went through. We'd go through and we'd show them our driver's license. They'd swap us for an ID tag, and they'd go through our literature boxes to make sure we weren't bringing in any contraband. And this one guy kept doing it and kept doing it. And I mean, he was, you know, I've learned that people that sometimes might think they may have a little bit of a problem with alcohol don't like us at all. And that's how this guy was acting. And so every month I'd go, and he'd get, you know, tougher and tougher. And one night he says, what is this book you're always bringing in here? And I thought, you know, I didn't think it actually. God just said, give him a book. And I said, all right, it's your call. So I handed him a big book, and I said, you know, here, why don't you take this, read it, check it out, and when you're done with it, bring it back and just throw it in one of the yards. Well, Laura and I were out in Lancaster, I don't know, 5-6 years ago or something, and I told this story for the very first time I'd ever told it. And here was the correctional officer in the meeting. And that was, you know, talk about that. Now, I've had inmates who have gotten sober, alcoholics that were incarcerated. They got sober and they've gotten out and they've contacted me. And you know, we've got that camaraderie going now. And one of the guys was up at Tehachapi State Prison. And he was the coffee maker. And he was not happy with his life. And he really thought it would be better if he just ended his life. And I'm talking, and God said to tell everybody that the coffee maker is the most important person in this room. And he heard me. And, you know, he heard God. And he didn't kill himself. When he got out, he contacted me on Facebook and asked if we could get together and have coffee. And he invited me to speak at a couple of the meetings that he was going to at the time. And you know, he thanked me profusely for letting him know that he was the most important person in the room that night. And it truly wasn't me telling him. You know, I still ask God to put the words in my mouth. You know, I kind of have an idea of what I'm going to say because I've got, you know, I've got a history in sobriety now. And so there's a lot of things I can talk about. Sometimes Laura tells me it's enough. Is it enough? Not yet. Almost. So, you know, our life has gotten really wonderful because of AA. We've been to, what have we been to? Four internationals? Three internationals. We've been to three internationals, and we love doing that. We've got a fifth wheel trailer and a nice big old four by four one ton truck to pull our trailer around, and that's gifts of the sobriety. You know, I would have lost the job that would have afforded me the ability to buy that truck. You know, if I hadn't stayed sober, I wouldn't have met Laura. And it's interesting how we met. We met in Beaver, Utah at the Great Outdoor Beaver meeting. And she, I had 9 years at the time, and she had 8 months. And and I immediately knew that, you know, that I think that would be 13-stepping. Probably not a good thing. And so we rationalized it, justified it, minimized it, and defended our right to go out with each other. And it seems to have worked pretty well. So, you know, we justified it. She'd had sobriety and had gone out, and she'd had sobriety again and had gone out, and she was back again. And she was putting every effort into it, and you know, so the two of us started dating, and we went out to Bobby's coffee shop, and we were sitting there. She says, let me take me up this way. I want to show you where I used to live with my dad. And so we went up there, and as we're pulling up to the house, I said, I went to a kegger party there. And she says, that was my kegger party, you know. I was 25, she was 20 at the time, and I went into this house and went to this party. There were, I don't know, 200 kids there and several kegs, and me and a buddy of mine went in. We had a good time. We partied for a while, and then we took off and never saw her again till Beaver, Utah. At least I didn't know I'd seen her before. And turns out that she and I have a couple of friends that have a Christmas party every year. And she was going to those Christmas parties, and I was going to those Christmas parties, but we didn't meet there. You know, we didn't meet there. She was with a man, and I was with a woman, and we didn't meet there. And then another couple of friends, we had had a New Year's Eve party. And I was going to those New Year's Eve party, and turns out she was going to those parties, but we didn't meet there. We met in Beaver, Utah. She was almost single. And I was almost single. We had both been dating exes, and I wasn't comfortable in my relationship and was trying to figure out a way to end that one. And then she was in the same boat, and we started dating, and we've had a lot of fun traveling. We were in Holbrook, Arizona. I love Holbrook, Arizona, because that's Dr. Bob's middle name, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith. And so we were in Holbrook, Arizona, and we were out checking out all this petrified wood, and we went to this kind of a sales museum type place. They had all kinds of things that weren't for sale. And then they had all kinds of petrified tables and lamps and chairs. And I mean, it was just a beautiful place. And we asked for, where's a good restaurant? And they told us where to go for a good restaurant. And we're headed down there. And on right next to the railroad tracks on the sidewalk was an A-frame sign with the circle and triangle. And I said to Laura, I said, Laura, there's an AA meeting as we drove by it. And I'm waiting for her to say something, you know. And I finally said, do you want to go? And she says, well, we always get along a lot better when we go. So I did a U-turn. We went back. We showed up, and it was like 7:01 or something. I don't know. They were already starting to do the readings, and we came walking into the meeting, and I think there were 8 people there as we walked in, and they stopped doing the reading and invited us in, sit down, join us. And we sit down, and this guy comes walking up, and he's got a couple of banana splits. Now, I love me a little ice cream. Okay, so he brought a banana split for the boat, one for each of us, and it was like, oh, right, this is great. You know, here I am in an AA meeting with my wife and a banana split. It doesn't get any better than that. Well, I love trains. So as we're sitting in this meeting, here comes a train, and the train was about 2 feet away from this building as it went by. And it was shaking the building, and the horn was blowing because the road was right there, so it's got to blow its horn when it drives through the road. And so I'm loving it, and the secretary hollers at me. He says, this too shall pass. And I said, oh, not too fast. Please, not too fast. You know, I have learned to embrace the journey. I really have. Laura and I have really, we've grabbed on to this one day at a time, embrace the journey, you know, be a part of. We've both lost our parents, and you know, there's some sadness that goes on with that, with the loss of a parent. But at the same time, through that, I learned things about my family that I didn't know before. You know, one of them was my great-grandfather used to come home. He was a farmer. And Saturday night, he'd go out with his buddies, and sometimes Sunday morning, he'd come up to the front door, and sometimes they laid him on the porch, sometimes they laid him on the lawn, and sometimes there was one time where he opened the front door, and as the door opened in, he fell out. And great-grandma would always leave him on the porch. You know, she was not an Al-Anon, or she was an Al-Anon. You know, so that was a story that I had never heard, and it was one of the things that, you know, endeared me to my family. And I'm pretty much the only alcoholic in my family. We have one that's out there in training, we think. We don't know, you know. That's one of the things we do here in AA. We don't diagnose anybody else. We diagnose ourselves and then work on ourselves. And I've learned that I can no more stay drunk today on yesterday's whiskey, you know, then I can stay sober on yesterday's efforts. You know, I'm here today because I want to stay sober today. This is all I have is today. You know, and we want to do the best we can with today. Laura and I get up every morning and we pray together and then we do some readings. I got these emails that I get that, you know, one of them is a Daily Reflections from New York. One of them is a friend of mine, Tim Whitcomb, that he sends me a daily reflection every day, and there's one from the Big Book from a gal in Arizona. And I get these readings, and Laura and I'll sit down and we'll read those. And then Laura and I also like to read Jesus Calling. We read whatever day's deal is for that. And it helps me and Laura to center ourselves into what are we here for? You know, we're here for our sobriety, and we're here to help somebody else get sober. You know, I know there were several people that raised their hands of being here for, you know, being new. You know, so get a hold of some of these old. I mean, there's a few old timers in here, and I mean old. And you know, get a hold of these guys. You know, and when I got sober, they said stick with the winners. I didn't know who the winners were, but I was sticking around with the people that were always at the meetings. And today I'm one of those guys that I'm always at the meetings. I can't stay sober at home. If I don't go to a meeting, I'm going to miss why, you know, I don't go to the meeting. You know, I've got to be there to see that this is a disease that will take us out. I mean, I've seen a lot of guys with time go get drunk again. And usually it's because they've stopped praying. They've stopped going to meetings. They've stopped sponsoring people. They're too busy. Their jobs are important. Whatever the case may be, it's the things I've seen. And I don't want that to happen in my life. I have two children that love me today. And they love my wife. And, you know, we have two grandchildren that we're allowed to take anywhere we want. We picked them up a couple of weeks ago and we took them to the Hollywood Bowl to see The Nightmare Before Christmas. And that was a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. And like Brent said, I'm a wuss. I do cry. And they're always tears of joy. I've got to do a lot of things in sobriety. And I thank God for my sponsor. I thank God for all of you. I thank God for my sobriety. And I thank you guys for the God of my own understanding. And may you guys have a very blessed day. Thank you.
Maybe we recorded it, maybe we didn't.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm in bed. I'm not a holiday. Again, Dusty, thank you so very much, sir. Thank you, God. Ben, good job, sir.